Hello and welcome to Happy Place. I'm Fern Cotton and this is the podcast that celebrates the process of learning and allowing ourselves to evolve. Today I'm meeting, oh my goodness, I'm so excited, a feminist icon. It's Catlin Moran.
This is also the first time that women across the world, of all ages, wherever they are, have been able to communicate with each other. So when I have to tell my children the bad news about being a woman, the good news is also, but you're part of this amazing tribe of 4.5 billion women, and we've invented this thing called feminism, which is this amazing informal network where women are identifying these problems, talking to each other and coming up with solutions. And although it's a difficult time to be a young woman, I have no doubt that things will get better. I know that our daughters' lives will be better than ours were.
Catlin is a journalist, author and broadcaster. And when it was released in 2011, her book How to Be a Woman was for many of us a first introduction to 21st century feminism. Now she's written More Than a Woman because it turns out all these conversations continue to change as society shifts and as we move through different stages of our lives. Feminism isn't just something you can do once, tick the box, done, thank you very much. And can I just say that More Than a Woman is the funniest book I've ever read. I laughed, I howled out loud, as well as it being super poignant and very, very beautiful. Now, I will warn you, there is plenty of fruity-tooty language, wild fruity language in this chat. So if you're not wearing headphones, you might want to dig them out, especially if there are young people about. Warning, warning.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, what I will say is before I recorded this conversation, I was feeling really rubbish, like a bit just grim and everything was going a bit wrong that day. And I felt like the heaviness of all this craziness that's going on in the world on my shoulders. I had friends going through stuff and I was just feeling awful. And I sort of didn't have much energy. Anyway, ever the professional, got my microphone out, ready to chat to Catlin. And this chat just like was a gear change for me. It snapped me out of feeling rubbish. It brought a massive smile to my face. And honestly, I felt fine afterwards. I just got on with my day. This is the power of Catlin. So if you're feeling a bit rubbish too, I promise you that this chat will cheer you up. Right, here's the show. Catlin, how you doing?
My darling, trifle hungover, cut the pina coladas in a tin last night, so feeling a bit dry inside, but brave, stoic and positive.
Good. Well, that you've ticked every box. That is good news. And you are on a book tour or you've just finished a book tour?
In the middle of a book tour, yes. So started in Bradford last week, finishes in Edinburgh next week.
And how's that going? This is all for your paperback edition of More Than a Woman, which, oh, I needed. I needed to laugh out loud several times during the read of this so badly. So thank you for writing this brilliant book. Thank you.
Well, busy middle-aged women are kind of underserved by books that go, I see you, and here's some jokes about the shit you're going through. And yes, that was very much the motivation for writing it. And the live tours are bearing this out. Like, I mean, as we know, there is no one who can party harder or more efficiently than a mum who's paying for babysitting. So they come out, they drink hard. We always have to delay the start of the events for about 15 minutes because always a surprised man from behind the bar will come and go, your fans, they drink a lot and they're ordering pints of white wine.
Yes.
You get like sailors on shore leave, you've got 24 hours to just hit New York, get in and get out. And they just do that.
Oh, I love it. Honestly, this book filled me with joy. And, you know, not only is it, and I read a lot of books and I don't often laugh out loud. It's a real skill to be able to get someone to belly, like a belly laughing out loud. But not only that, it's so
beautiful and poignant and thought-provoking in so many ways. And it's really interesting. Well, obviously, I'm a huge fan of you. And looking at your work over the years, but especially the margin of time between this book and How to Be a Woman, and what's changed in the world, what's changed with you personally, what's changed with your own sort of perception of life and how you see it now. That was super interesting.
Right, because like, I mean, as we say, the world has changed an enormous amount in the last 10 years. When I wrote How to Be a Woman, a big part of the motivation was that just we had stopped talking about feminism. Like, kind of, it was being used as an insult. Sort of the majority of women would not claim themselves as feminists. And as we're starting to realise now with the Britney Spears documentary, sort of the early noughties, I think, were one of the worst times for womankind, sort of like since the end of the Second World War. It was a killing field out there, particularly for prominent women. We think of the Charlotte Church countdown clock, Amy Winehouse, Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears. Like, you know, in the media and even in women's magazines that are supposed to be on women's side, the tone that was taken towards women was basically they were just like silly bitches that needed to sort their minges out and buy a handbag. And
yeah.
And, you know, always sort your minge out and buy a handbag if you wish. But but there was so much more to being a woman than that. And I just wanted to sort of, you know, have being a feminist, just explain to women who really needed it at that time that feminism isn't, as some people think, just angry women with lots of rules. It's a set of tools that allow you, whenever you're having a problem in your life, you feel scared or you feel not listened to as a woman, that feminism has probably been there before you and talked about this and is offering you some solutions. So in the 10 years since then, like, feminism has just been extraordinary. We see it everywhere. We talk about women's lives so much more than we did 10 years ago because of the rise of social media, but we still tend to talk about younger women's lives. And How to Be a Woman was about what I realized was now a luxurious time when the only problems in my life were my problems to do with me sorting myself out, me making mistakes. And we see so many TV shows now that talk about that. Broad City, Girls, I May Destroy You, Fleabag. And there's nothing about the next stage in your life when the problems in your life aren't you but other people. You have children, you have aging parents, you have friends who are divorcing. And the role often of a middle-aged woman is to be the one in the middle of this all, sort of holding together the threads of society with their bare trembling hands for no money or pay or claim whatsoever. So I was like, that's the next book that needs to be written. We've done hot messes. Now let's talk about the middle-aged women who have to get things done.
And that seemed like almost a surprise to you, because when you finished How to Be a Woman, you explain in the new book that you kind of thought, all right, I'm 35, the hard days are over. Now it's just plain sailing, chilling, kicking back. And in this book, you seem to be like, oh, fuck, I was really wrong there.
Oh, totally. Well, I start the book because I was like, if you possibly can in a book, rip off basically the plot to Back to the Future, do. So the book starts with me at the age of 34 on the day that I finished writing How to Be a Woman going, ha, I know everything about being a woman. It's all going to be easy now. And I really did think that middle age had to be the bit where it got easy and that you would basically sort of waft around in beautiful linen trousers, having long lunches with girlfriends and sort of maybe in the south of France. And of course, you're laughing. Any middle-aged woman who's listening to this is laughing because that's not what middle age is about at all. So I get me now at the age of 46 to go and visit me at the age of 36 in the first chapter of this book, just to laugh at her, basically. Just to go,
it's brilliant.
You think you know everything. You know nothing.
But we have to keep thinking the next bit's easier. Otherwise, we would hide under a rock and never ever emerge again into the real world.
Oh, totally. And like, you know, and there are so many joys of being a middle-aged woman. This isn't by any means a memory, memoir. Like, kind of like, you know, you do, you know, as you lose skin elasticity, you lose the amount of fucks that you give. You know what you like. And like, you can sort of curate your life a bit like a all bangers playlist. Like the things that you tried in your sort of your early years. You know, for me personally, anal sex. Like, it was the 90s. We had to try it. That was what you did if you were kind of an adventurous young lady. And now I'm just like, no, that's a poo area.
And
if a man is tired of vanilla and missionary position sex, then he's tired of Fanny. Like, that's
exactly. He can bog off. God, where do we go from here? You know what? I need to just rewind 1 minute because I want to talk about that era that you just spoke about where we weren't really talking about this stuff back in the early noughties, and there was misogyny everywhere. And I look back and my toes curl because not only did I not have a proper understanding of what it was to be a feminist, I sort of willingly went along with a lot of the stuff that was happening. So I was definitely one of those people that was battered in the press for being a sort of blonde, thick, whatever, you know, bimbo on the TV. And I was really berated relentlessly at points. And I kind of just thought, I can't say anything about this. I have to just keep my mouth shut and carry on. And there were lots of other things that I don't know if I even want to go into, but definitely plot lines that I went along with because I thought this is just how it is. And I used to relentlessly get asked in interviews in my early 20s. There was a real phase where it was a trend to go, are you a feminist? And I felt like I was sort of being tricked because...
It was a trap, yeah.
Yeah,
certainly.
Because I thought I believe in equality. I know that I've been brought up by a tenacious mother who, you know, has always stood up for everything she believes, still does to this day, like vehemently. But I thought, I don't know if I qualify as one. And obviously today I'm like loud and proud. I understand it fully. I love dissecting this subject and talking about it. But back then I thought, what are you looking for me to say? What could I get wrong here? It was such a strange time.
Oh, totally. And, you know, I can remember seeing you in the press and it was a brutal time. It was much more controlled by men than it is now.
Yeah.
You would sort of like, there was that real thing of like, there'd be one girl allowed in the room and kind of like, you know, you would be the girl. And we think, oh, well, at least there's one girl in the room, that must help. But it doesn't, because you need to have a group of girls in order to see female culture and for women to be able to communicate with each other normally. Like, kind of, in How to Be a Woman, I talk about this, like, if there's just one woman in the room, it's like putting a single flamingo in the penguin enclosure in a zoo. Like, that flamingo is going to start acting really oddly after a while because it's not with others of its kind, and the penguins are going to think it's weird, and the penguin will start plucking its feathers out and kind of, like, you know, having a really weird time in that enclosure. And that's, you know, the noughties and the 90s were really, really big for that. And sometimes I do blame the Spice Girls for this, because in the early 90s, we'd had Riot Girl, big sort of feminist explosion of sort of fanzines and punk rock and sort of strong women and stuff. And then when the Spice Girls came along, we stopped talking about feminism. We started saying girl power instead. And although it was great to hear 9-year-old girls saying that, girl power just basically meant buying Spice Girls records and being friends with your friends. Whereas feminism is this whole thing that's gone on for a century that will apply itself to every aspect of your life. So that was why I wanted to write a book that was really accessible, because at that point in the early noughties, as you say, it was a trap to ask women if they were feminists. And if you said you were, then people just thought that you were a grumpy, man-hating woman in dungarees. And let's not forget, grumpy, man-hating women in dungarees have got a lot of stuff done. Like, I love them. They went on those marches, they got that stuff done. But there are a billion different kinds of feminism. Everybody's is slightly different. Like, everyone is welcome in the big feminist zoo. Come along,
yes, of course, all flamingos welcome. And, you know, of course, some still don't fully understand it and will still feel confused by it, which is fine. You know, that's why we want to keep discussing these subjects. But do you think part of the problem is because the word patriarchy gets flouted about so flippantly and that's misunderstood as well?
Totally. I mean, there's a bit in, I can't remember if it's in this book, where I explain that when you talk about patriarchy to men, they often think they mean them.
Yes.
Like, kind of, and it's like, no, I'm talking about the patriarchy, not you, Patrick. You're just a man. You're not the man. Like, kind of, there's a difference. And patriarchy is screwing over men as much as it is women. Like, I went on Twitter about a year ago and said, look, I'm always talking about women's problems because I'm a feminist. But men, like, what are your problems? I got thousands of replies. It went on for months. It got picked up as news stories around the world. And it was really interesting being able to see a pattern in the replies that men were getting. And at first you couldn't see it because some of them were silly. So, you know, seemingly silly, like, no one ever buys me flowers because I'm a man. Like, kind of, and you're like, well, you know, I have to run down the street with my keys between my fingers. So, you know, that's slightly different.
Yeah, exactly. Like, sorry.
I can cope without getting flowers. But then you're like, well, no, hang on. Let's think about that for a minute. Why? Flowers grow in nature. Like, they're there for everyone. Why is suddenly one half of the population not supposed to have them? Not to have something that is joyful and beautiful and that will make you feel happy. And so I was retweeting all these replies and one guy went, I read you saying about men don't get flowers. And I went and gave my 79-year-old dad a bunch of sunflowers because I know they're his favourite. And he burst into tears and went, no one's ever given me flowers before. Mm. So that seemed like a small thing. But you're like, OK, we're onto something here. Men aren't supposed to have joyful things or sort of do nice things for each other or sort of have emotions. And then sort of more serious things like men going, now, if I see a child who's lost or scared in the playground, I don't feel I can go over and help that child because people will think I'm a paedophile or creepy. Like, I have to go and find a woman. And again, I suddenly thought, well, wow, maybe there is such a thing as female privilege here because, you know, there are many downsides to being a woman, but I've always known I can help people and I've always known I never scare anyone. And for a young man, particularly boys of colour as well, to go from being like a little cute boy and suddenly you shoot up a bit and your voice breaks and suddenly you're seen as a threat or a weapon, and you know you scare people just by walking into a room, and at least that's something as a woman that I've never had to experience. So, but all of these, you know, this is the patriarchy, the idea of there are man things and there are woman things, And I talk to a lot of young men in schools, and there's been a growing trend recently of young men who say they hate feminism, they see it as a cancer. I think they see that women seem to be winning at the moment. They do seem to be gaining. And if you think about it from a young man's point of view, like kind of in the last 10 years, the charts are full of songs about how great it is to be a woman. We're talking about sort of women starting to take over Hollywood. Sort of all the big hot shows of the last couple of years have been female led. And, you know, schools have feminism clubs. And in the last 100 years, women's lives have changed exponentially. Like in the last 100 years, we can now own property. We can vote. We can go into space. We can wear trousers. We can talk about sex. We can own property. We can run businesses. We've taken all these things that were previously just male things, and we've got them now. So we've gained something in the last 100 years. Palpably, our lives have got better. It's exciting. In the last 100 years, men's lives, have they changed at all? Have they taken anything that is a female thing and had it to expand their lives and feel like their lives are changing and it's different to be a modern young man? They haven't really. Like, kind of sort of it stopped. And I think a lot of that is because the things that are seen as female, like talking about your emotions, parenting, flowers, you know, wearing pretty clothes, all these things that men were saying were a problem, because they're female, they're seen as lesser. And so whereas, you know, when a woman's going, yes, I'm going to smoke cigarettes and run a business, you're like, that's a man thing. That's powerful. I can see why you'd want that. Whereas if a man goes, I really would like to wear a pink shirt and have flowers and cry with my children over a Pixar movie, it'd be a bit like, oh, that's a bit girly. That's a bit wet. Like, that's not powerful. Why would you want that? So that's what we're talking about when we talk about the patriarchy. It's how the patriarchy is bumming men as hard as it is bumming women.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, it's interesting there, you sort of talking about the progression of how women move in the world today. And obviously that's extremely exciting. But, yeah, there is still quite a large hangover that we're still dealing with. Because if I think back, I don't know about your own personal lineage, but it's only as far back as my nans who were sort of encouraged after birth to not work. So, you know, we are one of the first generations to have not only jobs, but careers, things we're deeply passionate about and things that we're running with full time and long term. And that's brilliant. But there's a sort of an emotional hangover and a practical one. And the emotional one, again, it doesn't sound like a very sort of feminist thing to say, but my own emotional hangover is the guilt of that, is the balance of that. And I mean, that's fresh. That is new guilt two generations away.
Yeah, oh, it's so fresh. And also, part of that's part of the push and pull of parenting. Like, you know, yeah. I've got a theory that we're chemically addicted to our children because, you know, when they're little, you can't wait for them to go to school so you can finally get work. It's like they're on you, they're in you, they're around you. Just like, go to school, go, 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 go. And then, I don't know about you, but 20 minutes after they've gone, I'm going into their empty bedrooms and just like sniffing their pillows.
Sniffing
and going,
things.
I miss those guys.
What's wrong with us?
I know. I think we're chemically addicted to them. And there are studies that when men are around babies, after half an hour, their testosterone levels drop by a half. So we are being chemically manipulated by our children to some degree. So some of it is stuff that we just is happening on a really base animal level. And the guilt is one of them. Women know that they're supposed to be with their children all the time and love ceaselessly. Like the very last thing you should do is just still be loving your children. Like kind of that's, you know, until you die, the second you die, you've got to be there and on your kids. And of course, that doesn't work. 79% of the families have two working parents. And this system doesn't work. And you realize that it's because we still haven't adjusted to the fact that most women work now and have children. So when I don't know about you, but like when I went and had a talk with my accountant, I'm self-employed about what I could claim, and I sort of said hopefully childcare, because there's nothing
you
more
can't.
Important as an expense.
No.
I can't, but what I could claim is membership to a golf club.
Yes.
Because I could then host potential clients. So clearly no women have ever been in the room when we were talking about tax laws.
No.
In this country.
But this is a practical solution that, like, it's so obvious. When I read that in the book, I was like, it's so obvious, yet I've embarrassingly never, ever thought about that. I kind of still think it's a bit of a treat that I get to go to work and have a career. Like, oh, lucky me, my grandparents didn't get to. And it's like, oh, that's so messed up.
Oh, no, totally. And I don't know about you, but like kind of every year you get to the end of a year and go, how did we manage that with kids? Because like, you know, in a job, you get 4 weeks of paid holiday if you're lucky. So if the pair of you together, if there's two of you parenting, that's 8 weeks you've got. The school holidays are 8 weeks long. Easter's 2 weeks. You've got three half terms. You've got 2 weeks for Christmas. The maths just don't add up.
Nope.
And like, and at the end of every year, you've managed it, but you have no idea how. I still couldn't tell you now how and who was looking after our children for the 10 years when they were young. We somehow got through it. Like, sometimes I'd be sitting on Brighton Beach with my children in those Zorb balls, you know, like those hamster balls. And they'd be rolling up and down. You pay a fiver for it. They can do it for 20 minutes. And I'd just be sitting in the rain on a laptop, quickly writing something.
Another fiver.
Yeah,
another
quick,
fiver.
Keep them in the balls. Oh, no, one's gone in the sea. Okay, that gives me another 10 minutes.
I know. And know, especially this last year with homeschooling. I mean, there was some unbelievable moments of like, oh, here's my son talking to George Ezra whilst I'm doing the podcast. Come in, come join. It's all good.
How were you as a teacher? What was your teaching style? How did you
I wasn't. I just wasn't. I was so shit. The first 2 weeks I was filled with a real optimism and I just thought, this is it. This is the way to live. We're going to learn about follies and faults one day, and then the next we're going to do the Industrial Revolution, and I had this whole sort of plan that felt joyous. We were picking subject matters out of a box to make it fun. I thought, I'm nailing it. Literally week three, I was like, I'm going to die. It's not possible. And I started to be, I got really shit at my job because I was just, my brain was bulging out of my skull.
Well, they've changed maths. When did they change maths?
I am so bad at maths.
What the fuck is that? Like, kind of the way you add up now. Like, adding up is the simplest thing. You're supposed to put them in a column, and then that's the thing. They've changed the way they lay out maths, the order of it. They've changed all the bits of it. Like, why is that on the news? They should have told us that on the news.
I don't know.
What?
I don't know. I mean, I was shit at school, so I can't be expected to be a teacher now. I was useless. It's like, I don't know. That whole thing was just a massive shit show, but hey.
It was so bad. It reminds me of my worst ever parenting moment was before the pandemic a couple of years ago. It was the first day of the school holidays. It's 10:30. I'm in the kitchen. I'm working as fast as I can. Don't know where the kids are, but they're quiet, so that's okay. There's a ring on the doorbell.
Is it okay, though? Quiet means trouble.
Well, as we know, silence is deadly. Yes. So ring on the doorbell. There's a community police officer on the door. And he goes, hello, sorry to trouble you, but did you know that your children are hanging their bare bottoms out of your upstairs bedroom window and shouting, free at last, free at last? And I was like, no, I did not know that information. Thank you for the tip off. I'll go and sort that out now. 10:30 on the first day. It got worse from there.
That is just so brilliant. I mean, that is the only snapshot you need to remember from 2020.
Yeah,
that is it, surmised.
That's parenting in a nutshell. Just a policeman knocking on the door going, did you know? No, I didn't. Sorry. I failed. There we go.
Oh, it's so hard.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There are so many bits of advice I underlined in the book. I'm going to keep going, well, to both books, but I'm going to keep going back to this book like it's a sacred scripture, because there's so many things. And I mean, one of my favourite ones, I don't think we've ever dropped the C-bomb on here, but don't marry a cunt is one of my favourites.
So true, right? Preach, absolutely preach.
Preach, absolutely yeah. Preach. And then another one which moved me to my core is, I'm reading it out verbatim because it needs to be, never, never, never allow yourself to start seeing your body as a collection of separate problematic items. Now, I'm imagining every single woman listening to this right now is going to go, ugh. It's that, like, it's a sigh out of, oh, I do this all day, every day.
But we're
all day, every day. I know.
Yeah.
What the hell are we going to do about this? Because you've nailed it. Like, you know, I'm very well aware that there's many flaws in society when it comes to looking at the female body. And I've fallen into every hole with that one. And, you know, reading your book made me realise how much shit I put my parents through on this subject, like loads of stuff. But the way that you've structured that sentence is like, oh my God, we've just pulled our bodies apart and we see it all as these little separate bits. It's awful.
Well, totally. I do the list of all the things like, you know, cottage cheese thighs, knee overhang, bingo wings, muffin top, like kind of, none of those things exist. Fat back. None of those things exist. They're just like consequences of wearing clothes that aren't the right size for you or something that someone's completely made up. Like kind of, it is your body. It's the only one you're ever going to have. You live in it until you die. It is your eternal friend. And you wouldn't talk to your best friend in the way that you talk to yourself about your body. And you have to. But the thing is, it's seen as, we don't realise how deep-rooted this is, it's seen as impolite for a woman to be happy about her body, I think.
I know. Like,
I have to read the celebrity gossip magazines every week for the column I write in the Times about celebrity on Friday, which is a nice column about celebrity. I boggle at things. I'm on people's side. But without exception, whenever they interview a female celebrity, they will say at some point, so what's the bit of your body you hate the most? They never ask men this. I've never seen Bradley Walsh being asked this, but kind of every woman is asked this. And every single woman in the world who we think of, we know, is beautiful, will have to, when someone says you're beautiful or mentions it when they're interviewing them, go, oh, no, you know, I look so rough, or I've got really weird elbows, or my toes are so freaky, or kind of like my husband can't even look at my legs. And like, it's seen as polite. You have to put yourself down. You couldn't. For years, I've wanted to, and I still don't have the balls to do it. I've wanted to write a column in the Times just going with a picture of me looking as I am. I'm a sort of size 14, 46-year-old woman covered in stretch marks, and just go, I genuinely believe I am beautiful and hot. Like, kind of,
you
like,
have to write this article though. Like, you have to do that.
I know I will get so much shit on the internet from people who don't understand it, but like, I want to write it for women who have never read or seen a woman ever go, I think I'm really beautiful, I'm really happy with the way I am. I've never seen anyone say that.
Just no, I haven't. And look, being the first is hard, isn't it? Being the first person, like as you say, you probably would get people that just miss the point entirely and project their own shit, because it's nothing to do with you, onto you. But I just think it would be the most beautiful thing, because I'm the same. You know, I've got a daughter and a stepdaughter. You've got daughters. We need that to become completely normalised, utterly, utterly normalised. And we're so painfully far from that place. It makes me feel so sad.
And it not being seen as vanity or like shitting on other women. Nope. It's just like, no, it's just that we need to be able to say in 2021 that we think we're beautiful and pretty and hot. Like, we need to be able to say that and to feel it in our bones. And the other trope that I notice so much is men describing women. Like, women are constantly being described to themselves by men. Like, sort of in interviews, men just talking about how you look. Just like, stop describing me.
Yeah.
Stop telling me what I look like. And also, if I were in government, the first rule I would bring in is that I'd like it to be a year, but realistically, we could probably only manage a week. I'd like us to have a week where we have no opinions about women at all. We don't have a hot take about Meghan. We don't have a hot take about Billie Eilish.
Yeah.
We're just, for a week, we're just not going to have opinions about women. We're just going to let them live their lives and they can have their opinions about themselves. That would be mind-blowing.
Opinions have gone mad. Opinions have gone mad. We've got to a really strange place, and it feels like we're really close to some sort of implosion, because how can it get any worse? Everybody is so opinionated about things that have zero bearing on their lives, but are so ferociously opinionated about things. And it's just like, we've got to a place of sort of insanity with it, where it makes no sense at all to have all of these crazed opinions in a really acerbic tone that have no bearing on your life. Like, where do we go with that?
Well, it's because there's a marketplace for it. So, like, the stats are on social media, and sort of Twitter is the sort of main driver of this kind of unpleasantness, is that you get three times more engagement if someone's saying something angry or has got kind of a hot take or an edgy take than you have by someone going, here's a really lovely video, here's a smashing thing, here's a song I love. So that's what succeeds. We've changed the algorithms and we've got a marketplace where that's more successful. So, we've become part-time, unpaid opinion farmers. And like, that's the game. It's the gamification of opinion. Like, you go there and you get your little dopamine hits if someone likes it or retweets it. And we're sort of looped into this sort of chemical sort of system on social media where we're rewarded physically and chemically every time we're a bit cunty. And I just think in the future, in the same way that our Fitbits sort of register our footsteps or kind of, you know, our menstrual cycles, that it will start to tell us in the future, our readout from our dopamine and adrenaline hits from being on social media, from reading good and bad things. And it will, a little thing will flash up and go, you need to get off social media now. You've had enough. You've triggered your dopamine reactors 30 times today. That's not healthy. Get off. Go for a walk. Go and hug your dog.
Yeah, I had the alarm bells ring this week on that one. Just, I'm finding the world very, very noisy at the moment. And I'm not really built for that sort of thing. I am. I feel like I'm being like bruised the whole time, and I've just had to sort of shut down from a lot of it this week. And maybe next week I'll feel absolutely capable and like, oh, I can dip in and out of it. But at the moment, I'm just finding it so loud, and I've been going into real sort of like low dips of feeling so shit about everything. Like, not any one specific thing, but just, it's just so much. And I just, I like fairness, I like kindness, and I just don't know what to do with that information.
Well, there's one really interesting statistic. So on social media, your social inhibitions are lowered to the point where you're basically in the same level of inhibition as if you've drunk 1 to 2 pints. So once you understand that the entire internet is just a bit drunk, and looking for a fight and a bit horny. Like, kind of, you're like, oh, okay. So why would I be clicking onto a portal where I'm basically walking sober into a pub where people are already quite aggy? But it's interesting because you're in yoga, you do a lot of balances, don't you? I've noticed when you do your post your yoga practice, and that's all about stilling your mind and only thinking about one thing. It's just you.
I literally have to. I have to do something to counterbalance it because my mind is too much of a delicate thing and it will tip and it will spiral and it will go. And I have to just keep bringing myself back. Or sometimes just like before I spoke to you today, I just sat at my desk here and I didn't look at my phone and I didn't listen to music and I just sat for half an hour in silence because I thought I need space. I don't even know why or what that space will bring me, but I need a bit of nothingness because we're so bombarded at the moment.
But when we were kids, we had endless nothingness. Like, this
idleness,
is a big difference.
Constantly.
Yeah, I mean, and boredom, but in such a good way. We used to have a game called Crying, which is where, because there was no TV, like, you know, four channels and like no internet and stuff, and we'd have a game where we stared out the window at the wires from the pylons that we could see outside the window, and you had to stare at them for as long as possible without blinking until you started naturally crying, your eyes started to water.
That's
a great game for us. Yeah, that was great. I love crying. It was so good.
We were so deprived back then. It was brilliant. But idleness is important, and I'm trying to definitely get back more into it, especially due to all this bloody noise that we're dealing with.
Ironically, the only way I think a busy woman can have idleness and stillness is to put it on her to-do list. Like, I realise now, because all women have a to-do list, and it's endless, and it's got 500 million things on it. And you just need to... I realised the big mistake I was making with my to-do list is that I was not on my to-do list. And you need to put on, in the day of clipping the dog's toenails and putting up the curtain rail and sorting out the tax returns and stuff, you need to spend 20 minutes just on your own. And, like... Let's talk about yoga for a bit, because I know you're really into it and I'm into it too. I'm really evangelical about it now, because I was put off it for years because I thought it was very kind of spiritual and po-faced and kind of about perfection and stuff. And it was when I started watching my kids, and children naturally do yoga. They're going upside down, they're stretching, they're sort of, you know, sort of downward dog, all that stuff, naturally when kids are mucking about. And I realised that, like, for me, that's what yoga is. It's mucking about again like you did when you were a kid, because... You know, you get to 8 or 9 and suddenly it's like, sit still, sit straight, like, kind of like, be quiet, you know. Then you get tense and you find out you've been holding your breath from a really angry phone conversation you had in 1997. And just being told to take a deep breath and stretch and mess about is so liberating, I think, particularly for middle-aged women, because it costs no money. You can do it at home.
Yeah.
You can fit it in 10 minutes and it's just for you.
It's for you. It's for you. It's exactly that. And I think this is why your book spoke to me on every page, because it's looking for those moments, because life is so complicated at this stage. You know, whether you've got a family or not, it's just you've created your own circle of people and your own world, and then you get to a point where you've got to manage it, and you know the stuff you want to let go of, and you know the stuff that you absolutely love and want to keep in place, and that is so much to juggle. And I think, like you say, putting that on your to-do list or carving out some moments where you do something that just makes you feel good. Because I said to my husband this week, I was like, God, I mean, I've sort of put a lot of work in this last couple of weeks so that when the kids break up over summer, I can get a bit more time where I'm just at home. So I'm sort of doing double the amount now.
Yeah, there's no such thing actually as a holiday. There's just doing all the work before and after. Yeah.
Exactly. And having a pause where I'm just then shouted at by children, which is probably more fun. But I'm really like caning the work thing at the moment. And I got to a point where I sort of said to him, I don't even know what I like anymore, because I'd got to the point where I wasn't giving myself any time to find any joy for me. Because I was like, oh no, I need to clear out that sock drawer first, and then I have to clean school uniforms, and this is a never-ending list of stuff. And we kind of think that it's selfish to give ourselves any time or any joy, but it's, if we want to keep all that stuff going, it's imperative that we look for that time.
Well, it's like they say in the planes, you've got to put your mask on first before attending to others. And like, kind of, you know, mums need to make sure they've got their mask on. And the only way that you will do that is by putting yourself on your to-do list, because it won't naturally spontaneously happen. Like, you won't suddenly wake up one day and go, oh, I've got nothing to do. I know. I'll just go and do some gardening and then some lunch. Like, kind of, and go and look around RHS Wisley and get an inspiration on her.
I like it there.
Not going to happen. It's gorgeous, isn't it? Yeah.
It's lovely.
See, that's another thing, like, I really wanted to talk about, because so many, I think that there's this presumption that middle-aged women are just boring and everything they're into is boring. So, like, you know, I'm doing all the cliched, supposedly boring middle-aged things. Like, I'm into gardening. I'm into yoga. Like, I'm into wild swimming. I love my dog. But each one of those is actually amazing. We don't talk about these things like gardening. You need to be kind of a visionary time traveller, because when you're planning a garden, you've got to know that what that border is going to be doing. If you put this bulb here now in the middle of winter, then you'll have these beautiful vertical stalks in March. And then in May, you're going to have these pink flowers and they'll be playing against the purple that you're going to put over there. So you're playing this. You're like the conductor of an orchestra through time and space, like conducting this all in your mind and the flow you get into when you're tending your garden. Although I have started to anthropomorphise my garden a bit. I pruned too hard into a bush last week and took out quite a vital branch. And I found myself saying, I'm so sorry, dude. I know you've been working on that for ages.
Talk to the plants, talk to the trees. It's so important. I'm the same, and I am, again, fulfilling every cliche. But I think I kind of wanted to fulfil all those cliches in my 20s and 30s, but I just felt it wasn't the right time. I had to follow what you're meant to do, which is go out and get pissed. And yeah, some of that was really good fun, but I've always had a strong pull to being at home. Like, I am an absolute cliche hermit. I love pottering around. Pottering about is pottering is the best. And I've always loved pottering. And I think I just sort of have given myself full permission to do it. Whereas I've always sort of loved it, but denied myself of it. And now I'm just relaxing into that and I fucking love it. There's so many things I want to talk about in regards to parenting, because you very generously share a lot of your experiences over the last 10 years of parenting and raising two daughters as well. And, you know, you clearly state in this book that we don't live in a sort of feminist utopia. So there's a lot of work to be done. And I wonder how you've navigated that challenge of telling your daughters what you know about the world and what you've experienced and what you don't want them to have to go through versus letting them find some of the stuff out so the lessons are sort of embedded.
Yeah, it's really tough. Like, I think it's similar when you've got daughters. I think it's the same when I talk to my friends of colour. There's a day where you have to explain to your kids, particularly your boys, about racism. And that's one of the worst days of parenting ever. And like, particularly then talking to your young boys about sort of, you know, what might happen with them legally, and with them, you know, if they sort of come into contact with the police. And similarly, when you've got daughters, there's just a horrible day where you just have to start talking to them about sexual assault and rape and catcalling. And, you know, there's that, you know, I'm 46 and I still, when I hear footsteps behind me on the street, there's a Sarah Silverman sketch where she goes, when you hear those steps behind you on the street, every woman thinks, is this it? Is this my rape? Like, yeah. Kind of, is today the day it happens? And having to explain that to your daughters is incredibly dispiriting. And you have to sort of, you know, make sure that it's a blend of, you know, sort of advice and sort of ways to deal with that anxiety and to keep each other safe. But it's a really sad day because, like, you know, we hope that we're working to a future where in the future mums won't have to tell their daughters this stuff. But at the moment we do, and it's irresponsible not to. And you have to do it far younger than you think as well. You know, sort of like when you start talking to girls about these sort of issues, you find out that the kind of language that's being used in schools or images that you're being shown or the things that are being discussed, they're starting to happen at like 8, 9, 10. Like, and you're thinking, oh, I'll wait till they're 13, 14. By that point, they probably will have already seen, you know, 50 dicks sent to them on text messages. They will have already seen horrible pornography. And I feel, you know, especially with the sort of online free to access pornography that both sexes are seeing, we sort of talk about, you know, how bad it is for girls to see this stuff, the sort of violence and sort of hair pulling and spitting and stuff. But I think it's equally bad for boys as well. Yeah. I can remember once being at a feminist meeting and saying this, and someone went, no, boys love watching men being in control and hurting women. And I was like, the boys I know are scared watching Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
If they're watching like some kind of violent anal rape scene on a landing where someone's being bummed by someone who looks like Burt Reynolds, like, and then they're supposed to be the ones that do that to girls. And you hear terrible stories. As one mother said, her 16-year-old boy had come home from school in tears, and eventually he told her that was the day that he'd lost his virginity with his 16-year-old girlfriend. And he'd started to strangle her and she'd started to cry and go, I don't like it. And he went, oh my God, I thought that was what you were supposed to do.
Wow.
And how are we screwing up sex? Like, you know, cats do this on roofs, like kind of, you know, every other animal is managing to do this. But somehow this brilliant thing that should be fun and enjoyable and lovely and it's free, like kind of and relaxing, we've suddenly turned to this thing that no one's really enjoying and is scaring a lot of people. So
I know. Oh, God. I mean, how much of that, because, you know, you say in the book, never has there been a tougher time to be a young woman, which I wholeheartedly agree with. And I'm wondering how much of that is just simply down to technology.
Yeah, no, it's a huge part. I mean, I think it is a mixed bill, but girl being a young woman, because obviously sort of like the rise of online pornography is, you know, is huge. Like, you know, something like 98% of kids get their primary, their first sort of sex education from watching that way before it's talked about in school. And obviously social media for women is full of trolls and death threats and dick pics and stuff. But on the other hand, this is also the first time that women across the world of all ages, wherever they are, have been able to communicate with each other. Previously, you could only sort of, if you got, you know, you had to have a newspaper column or you had to be famous or kind of like tour. But now anyone can talk. And if we see what's happened in feminism, as soon as women have had access to other women and to be able to talk, there's all these terms in the last 10 years like gaslighting and the Bechdel test and Me Too and coercive control that just normal women have come up with. These aren't academians. These aren't like professional feminists. Just a woman somewhere recognised a problem, named it, and then suddenly was able to share it with the world so women could go, oh, my God, I thought that was just happening to me and it was because of mistakes I made. But this is happening everywhere. And there are ways that we can stop this and there are ways that we can prevent it. And that's... So when I have to tell my children the bad news about being a woman, the good news is also, but you're part of this amazing tribe of 4.5 billion women. And we've invented this thing called feminism, which is this amazing informal network where women are identifying these problems, talking to each other and coming up with solutions. And although, you know, it's a difficult time to be a young woman, I have no doubt that things will get better. I know that our daughters' lives will be better than ours were. If you think of some of the stuff that you would have heard at 16, things you would have thought, things that people were saying to you.
Yeah. Oh, just some of the stuff that I went through as well. Like, you know, as I said, when I was reading your book, I was getting sort of flashbacks of, why did I put up with this shit? What constantly? And I know that my daughter and stepdaughter won't. I know that that will not be the case. And even, like I said, between your two books, on the theme of feminism, that you can see that there's, you know, just there is progress in great ways, as well as lots of, you know, shitty things happening.
Well, some of the shit that you got in the press and the way that people would talk about you and kind of the language that was used to describe you and stuff. Now, if that happened, even if that stuff was published, because I think people are a lot more wary about saying that really overtly sexist stuff now. But even if it was, and we still see things now, you've got millions of girls who would read that, go, no, that is sexist bullshit. Yeah. They would blog about it. They would tweet about it. And like, now any woman can have hundreds, if not millions, of other women come to their defense. Like when we talk about the Britney Spears documentary, when Britney was going through those terrible years, it was only men making jokes about it on late night TV shows and writing columns about it. If that was happening to Britney now, it's still awful, but women seeing that would go, no, I can see what's happening here. That's a mental health crisis. The way she's being pursued is horrible, and they would be writing about it as it happened. But it wouldn't take 10 years as it has now for us to finally go, whoa, that was weird. Because women were looking at that at the time and going, that's weird. But they couldn't talk about it anywhere. They couldn't campaign about it. So we have in many ways been freed by the social media technology, because at least we can talk to each other. That is where we change things.
Yeah, it's a beautiful point. And again, you know, thank you for sharing so much about your own challenges with bringing up your daughters, because I found it so helpful. And like I said at the start, I found it helpful in terms of looking at my own years as a teenager and, you know, 20 something, but also looking at how I want to raise my girls as well. Because, you know, you talk in depth about your daughter's mental health challenges and her eating disorder. And again, trying to find that balance between wanting to problem solve, wanting to be the solution and to execute this demon that she's having to deal with, but you can't. And I wonder how you coped with that with your own mental health. How did you move through that, knowing that at times you couldn't do it? You were helpless. You couldn't do anything.
Yeah, it's so tough. I mean, there's so many things you don't expect about parenthood that you don't sort of imagine when you're getting pregnant or trying for a baby. And I suspect that one thing women never think about is, might I have a child with a profound mental illness or an eating disorder? You just don't want to think about that. But the statistics are massively on the rise. And so, yeah, so when my daughter first started, so when you get an eating disorder, it's usually the person suffering from the eating disorder at the beginning, it seems like a solution to them. They feel like they're being smart, like kind of this is solving their problem, because they're usually very anxious and depressed. And what I've learned now is that if you feel that you can't talk fully and honestly about your anxiety and depression and get the kind of response and help that you need and the listening that you need and the non-judgmentalness that you need, then, and my daughter explained this to me afterwards when she was better, she was like, I just thought when I heard about eating disorders, oh, that'll be useful, because then people can see that I'm sad all the time. I won't have to keep saying it. And so when we see self-harm, when we see overdoses, when we see eating disorders, that is still a communication, but it's someone going, I can't talk to you anymore. I've just got to show you. And so your job as a parent, if you have a child with one of these conditions, is to try and move them back a step and go from like, okay, you don't need to physically show me anymore. I hear you. Let's go back to talking. And the reason she'd had to develop this coping technique and show me how sad she was is that one of my biggest failures I learned was that I was scared of sadness. I had been brought up in a house where just no one cared if you were sad. Like, you were just supposed to crack on. Like, kind of, you know, there's eight kids. It's really busy. Like, sort yourself out. You know, put on a smile and get and crack on with it. And so when she first started being sad, I would first of all try to jolly her out of it. I would try to treat her out of it. Like, I bought you a pet rat and let's watch TV. I would try and reason her out of it. I'd give her these TED Talks at 2 a.m. Like, you know, you've got to eat. You know, your brain is growing. It will make you depressed. I get angry. Like, kind of, just do it. Like, it's your choice. Just eat the food. I get sad, like, kind of, I'd cry and be like, surely if you can see that I'm sad, then because you love me, you will want to get better. And none of that works. And it took me 3 years to realise that what I needed to do was to be able to look her in the eye and be able to say truthfully, I can see what's happening. I can see you are sad. You've got to name it with teenagers. You've got to say what you see. I see you are sad. I'm not scared of your sadness. It will pass and I will be with you all the way through this. We are together in this. And one of the reasons I wanted to write about this in the book is, first of all, I'm happy to say she's fully recovered now and had told me to write about this. And she said, you need to write about it because for my generation, teenagers, there is no stigma around mental health. You know, we talk about it all the time, but your generation or our parents, you're supposed to be helping us and you are screwed up about it. You don't know what to do about it. You panic. You do the wrong things. You get angry. You get sad. You need to tell people what you've learned now. And so that's what I've done in the book. I couldn't find the advice that I put in this book. I could not find anywhere. And I also couldn't find any hopeful stories. We know what the stats are on, you know, severe eating disorders. It's sort of only 1 in 3 will fully recover. But I wanted to tell a hopeful story because, my God, when you're going through it, you need a hopeful story.
Yes.
You need to at least believe you might be one of the ones that is fully cured.
Oh, absolutely. We have to have hopeful stories. There's not enough of them. And I gained so much from it because I think I was, you know, I had bulimia for 10 years in my 20s, which was, I'm sure, a reaction to the weird job that I had at a very young age and the criticism and all of that stuff that I was not coping with whatsoever, but had zero outlet to even dissect it or even think about it or process it. But it allowed me to sort of realise that because I've never, I kind of had an inkling, but to really, to lay it out as you did and for your daughter to be as astute as she is as well, to sort of see the angle that she's coming from and to look at the bigger picture, it really helped with making a bit of peace there as well. So, you know, thank you. It's a really powerful bit of writing and it's amazing. And I'm so glad that your daughter's doing well. It's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad. She's an incredible kid and, you know, she went through it with a fine tooth comb, so it's only what she's happy with. But she was right. Like, kind of, it is our generation that don't know how to deal with it. And you saying that, you know, you still haven't fully come to terms with it and understood it. Our generation just didn't talk about it.
No.
Like, there was such a shame around it. Like, you just would not mention it. Or if you did, people would just think you were a silly bitch and you should sort it out.
Totally.
Like, just, you know, kind of like, totally. It's attention seeking. You're being pathetic, or you're doing it because you're vain.
Yeah.
And you are so full of self-loathing and you so feel like you're trying to do the right thing and the good thing by doing this. Like, kind of like, this, you know, this will cure my problems. That to hear those kind of opinions, no wonder our generation never talked about it. No wonder you never processed it. Like, kind of, where was the place and the space and the words to talk about it?
There was no space to. And, you know, you touch on this in the book. There's no space for women to fail. Still, we still have a huge problem with this. There is no space for women to fail. And again, you know, this is very much my past experience. I was berated for things that I barely even, you know, didn't even do, or, you know, blame for things or whatever, all sorts of crazy stuff. And there's just no space for people to make mistakes anymore, which seems so peculiar because, well, first of all, how the hell are we meant to grow and learn and change? But also there's no single human that's walking through life without making mistakes. It's part of being a human, but on a sort of, not even just a public level, but on a general level where we're conversing with each other and discussing life, we're just leaving no space for women to fail. And that is so toxic.
Yeah. And also, you know, let's look at the word fail, like, kind of like that, what we could use there is learn. Like, kind of,
yeah,
like, you can only learn from screwing something up and doing something wrong. That's the quickest way that you find a new way to do something that's better. So rather than saying fail, I really do prefer to say learn. And when you say learn instead of fail, when you're saying there's no way that women can learn because you try and if you screw it up once, then that's it. You never get to learn anymore. You're taken away. You get that job removed. The stats are really big on this. Again, women and people of colour and people from the LGBT community, if they're given a promotion, a high profile promotion in a company or, you know, in media or whatever, if they are seen to fail, they are five times more likely to be immediately fired than a straight white guy would. So, like, kind of, you're just never allowed. Like, so then the pressure is, you know, these outlying women, these pioneers and people of colour that we see sort of taking these high profile jobs, you know, there's a real sense of like, okay, well, we've given someone not normal a go. Like, so come on then, like, kind of, all right. Like, you know that you're already walking into hostility when you do it, which, of course, makes you more nervous and more likely to fail. Mm. So, yeah, it's a very noticeable thing, like, kind of. And the other thing is as well that, again, sort of going back to some of the treatment that you got in the press and sort of all high-profile women, even yeah. still now with all this feminism,
yeah.
we think, oh, well, you know, they should be able to take criticism, or, like, you know, we treat women equally to men, we should be able to criticise them. But I realised recently how toxic this is. I was writing a column and I wanted to mention a famous woman as a shorthand for someone we all love, like, kind of, who's never been cancelled, who's kind of just been loved and we love them, like Michael Palin or Sir David Attenborough. And I had to be a young woman for the purposes of the piece, so I couldn't say Judi Dench. And I couldn't think of anyone, because every single high-profile woman in the world on repeated occasions has been yeah. destroyed, often for just having fat upper arms or saying the wrong word.
Yeah.
And it's not just that we're sort of, you know, sportingly picking off famous, rich, privileged people. What are the children who are watching this thinking?
Yes.
If even Michelle Obama, who works for charity and is elegant and funny and brilliant and generous and honest, has been, you know, been said that she's like the beard of her gay husband, has been destroyed for being a bad mother, all these things, then what girl watching that wants to now become an adult woman and try? Like, kind of, you're just like, we don't make being a grown woman seem like an appealing job.
No.
And that's one of the reasons, I think, why mental illness and eating disorders are so hugely on the rise, because girls are just going, I want to delay being a teenager. I want to delay growing up. I want to stay little, because you're trying to go across that battlefield from child to adult.
Yeah.
And who are the female role models who've taken a completely bomb-free, gun-free, bullet-free path across that piece of no man's
None.
Land?
There aren't any.
No one. You know you're going to go through absolute shit, whatever you do. However loved you are at the beginning, you're going to be Taylor Swift with your massive backlash. You're going to be Billie Eilish being cancelled. Like, kind of, like, it will happen to you.
It's terrifying. It's what is. I mean, I still don't cope with it. And I'm going to be 40 this year. That's why I don't do TV anymore. I can't go into that space. I cannot put myself in that space knowing that there 100% will be an attack. I'm happy in my own little world over here where no one pays any attention to me anymore, and it's fucking brilliant. I just do the job that I love. I get on with it. I always work from the heart. That's me. And the rest of it, I cannot deal with it. And that's somewhat, I've been in the industry for years and years and years, and I still can't. So to think of how little girls are viewing that, my mind explodes at the thought.
So the statistics of the kind of women who will put themselves up for those kind of high-profile jobs and go on TV and do those jobs where you know you're going to be hugely criticised, it's such a tiny outlying percentage of extreme extrovert, confident girls that are going to ever want to do that. So we're not seeing any introverts. You know, we're dominated by extroverts. We don't see any thoughtful introverts. We need that balance. But, like, so many people will go, I could be brilliant at this job, but I can't take the shit that will go with it. And we lose them. And this is always when I'm sort of talking about diversity, whether it be gender or racial or sexual or whatever. I think people think that sort of diversity and having equality, equal representation in everything, music, arts, TV, everything, would be like a luxury that we can tack on at the end. Like, kind of, oh, we'll let them through the door and they can have a go. Like, you know, that's a treat for them. It'll make us look like good guys. And it's not a luxury, diversity. It's a necessity, because the greatest resource that we have in the world isn't oil or gold. It's brains. It's people's brains yeah. and their hearts and their souls and what they have to give to us. And if we're siphoning off 99% of the people because they're the wrong gender or the wrong sex or the wrong colour, or they can't handle the pressure that will come with it, we are losing every day amazing albums, brilliant TV shows, incredible documentaries, incredible books, like, kind of, amazing performers. Like, they're just not, we're just, you know, it's another generation that we're going to waste, and then another and another, until we finally realise that we're going to be so bored and so lonely if we're only having, like, the 1% of extreme extroverts who think they can blast through and then survive yeah. in the world in the way that it is in the moment.
Yeah, who can survive in it? I do. It's a massive shame. And, you know, the obvious solution is just that there's more kindness out there. But that seems almost impossible at the moment. But again, you know, we have to be hopeful. We have to hope that there's going to be a revolution of sorts where, you know, kindness prevails, because it feels like the direct opposite of that at the moment. But
well,
I think
that's one of the reasons that podcasts have been so, like, disproportionately yeah. successful, because the kind of people who don't want to go on TV or do those big productions, this is little stuff that you can do from the heart, from a bunker, like, kind of. And that's, and the people love these, the intimacy of it, and you're hearing conversations and the kind of people that you wouldn't hear or see anywhere else, because anyone can make a podcast, let's face it.
Like, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I love that. I am sort of actively retreating at the moment, and very happily, you know, I'm happily hiding away and doing my little bits and bobs, because life's too short to feel all those feelings and to put yourself out there in that way. And I'm really content doing this. And I think obviously it's down to experience, but also age. And, you know, you talk about this in the book. You sort of start to round off the book by saying getting to this age is there's a huge element of undoing. And I found that really fascinating. And I think that's exactly what I'm the stage I'm at. I'm undoing and unlearning and shedding and just simplifying and making my life sort of smaller. What were the main things that you felt you had to undo as you reached this age?
I think it's such a thing that you do in middle age. If you think about it, sort of your teens and 20s, you're getting stuff, aren't you? Like, kind of buying stuff, like, kind of like, oh, it's some ironic stuff on a market. I just want stuff. You get stuff. And then you get to our age, and I'm now just obsessed with throwing things away. Like, kind of like, if a child has left something on the kitchen table for a day, it's in the bin. Yeah. Like, kind of, it's off to the charity shop. We want to get rid of things. Because I think you realise that, like, everything you've got, you sort of, it's in your mental inventory and it's a responsibility to it. And you've got to mend it or look after it or feed it or worm it or whatever, like, or have sex with it. And kind of like, I need to simplify all this stuff. So I'm really enjoying realising that, like, although, you know, as I discuss in the book, I think middle age is the point where there's the most pressure on women's time and energy, because you are caring for everyone. You're juggling your work and your children, your friendship groups. You do all this stuff. It pays off really well for women at the end, because men at this stage do still tend to have their careers dominate and everything else becomes secondary. But when men retire, when you talk to charities, older age charities or charities around loneliness, there's a massive problem with men. Once they retire, because they haven't done all this multitask juggling that we're doing now, suddenly with their big thing gone, their job, they don't know what to do. And if they've got divorced or their partner has died, they don't know how to go back in the world. They can't rebuild their lives. It kind of ends for them when their job ends and their identity dissolves. Whereas, although it's so hard for us to juggle friends and family and all these things now, when women retire, they start hill walking, or they form a charity, or they start learning pottery, or they do Zumba, or they start travelling the world. And they have a third act in their lives in a way that men don't. They either go back and repeat the second one, they marry for a second time and have new kids, or they go back and have the classic midlife crisis and repeat the first one, their teenage years, they get their tattoo, they get on the bike. So women win in the end. And the thing I'm really concentrating on now is trying to get more excitement for women of my age about our older years and reclaiming words like witch and crone and hag.
Witch is my favourite word.
Yes, because it's supposed to be a pejorative, right? But when you read about the lives of women who were called witches,
they're the greatest.
They are such badasses. They go and live in the woods. Yep. They know how to brew alcohols and potions and tinctures. So they know the medicines. They can get themselves drunk. They surround themselves with animals, cats and dogs, and particularly
charismatic crows. They're doing spells.
Right? Yeah, they understand psychology. Yes. Like, kind of, you know, that the whole thing about palm reading and stuff. Like, that's basically women who now would be psychologists or therapists being able to talk to someone about their emotions using the hand as a basis. They hang out with the rest of their coven and cackle into the middle of the night. Yep. That's everything I'm doing with my friends and my life. Like, kind of, I'm swimming in cold water, I'm brewing my potions, I'm hanging out with my animals, I'm with my friends. And I feel the fear is dissipating now. And I like you, I hate doing TV. I get offered a lot of it. I just don't want to do it. But I think by the time I get to 60, along with my skin elasticity, I will have lost the last fuck I give.
Yeah.
And I want to go on something like Have I Got News For You and just scare all the young copper comedians. I want to come on with, like, long grey hair, like the Wild Woman of London.
Yes.
Maybe with, like, a staff and a crow.
Yes, lots of rings, huge rings.
Yeah, and just terrifying them. And every time they try and make an edgy joke about a lady not being sexy, I'll just, like, literally point to my staff at them and go, you are cursed.
Yes.
My curse is now inside your mind. You are now cursed. And just witch the whole thing up.
I'm so for this. I'm steadily in my witchy years, probably prematurely. I'm all about the witch, and I think we need to fully reclaim that word. I absolutely love it, and I'm with you on that. We can fluff on our broomsticks together. I'm happily a witch. God, Catelyn, thank you. I can't thank you enough for, like, writing these books that have just changed so many women's and young girls' lives, and continue to, and talking about a really important stage of a woman's life, which is completely ignored on a societal level. I loved every word of your book. There were two bits that I keep thinking about, and they make me snort with laughter, and one of them... One of them is the...
I think I know what you're going to say. Go on.
Wait, there's two. One of them is the Jersey cow in the pair of Whistles jeans.
Moo. Yes. That is what you need to be when you're around teenagers who are kind of wigging out and bugging out and stuff. There's no point in being clever or funny. You just need to be a sympathetic, a sympathetic dairy cow called Daisy, just mooing supportively at your teenager. Because they're not really listening to you. You just need to go, moo, you're lovely. That's it. Clock off.
I was in bed weeping. And also, the line that resonated the most out of the whole book is when you talk about having a pivotal poo.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a day changer, right? When you have those... Yeah.
Oh, I had one this morning.
Changes the day.
It's just, it honestly sparks your day in the right way. It's bliss, pure bliss.
I like, you see, that's where Marie Kondo's missing a thing when she talks about things that spark joy. She never talks about a pivotal poo, does she? She's missing that one. I have to say, I thought you were going to, because the biggest response that I get from things where women are just going, yeah, this spoke to me, was that men's coughs and sneezes. Like, kind of, that seems to have hit a massive nerve. Just like, so the easily observable thing that when women sneeze, they just go...
Oh, Jessie's are... We talk about this all the time in the house. I don't understand why. Why so loud? But I'm more angry than finding that humorous because it pisses me off so much.
Furious. No, they're an act of aggression. Furious. Like, the whole street doesn't need to know. It's a massive performance. No. It's only when men are going to be sick. Like, they start talking about it 2 days before. They're like, oh, something's up. Like, kind of like they sort of tell you they're going to go and be sick, like kind of like they're going off to the electric chair. And you're like, I've been sick during dinner parties into a pint glass under the table and not stopped talking. I've been sick on a dance floor and not missed a beat. Yeah. Like, women can do a very quick, discreet lady bomb like that, like kind of, which is not... We just get on with it.
I was sick every day for my whole pregnancy. Every day.
Right.
9 months.
I invented the luxury vom. That's where, like, you make it nice. Like, you kind of, like, you fold a, like, nice towel for your knees. I'll put another one on the seat so you can rest your head. And then I'll just prop up a copy of Grazia.
Love.
Just go through the kind of recommendations for, like,
your
sort of beach
spa
bags.
Vom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, literally. And sometimes that's the best bit of the day.
Oh, Catelyn, you are the best. I absolutely adore you. Thank you so much. It's an honour to have you on the podcast.
Oh,
and
God,
just keep
right
doing what you do.
I love what you're doing, mate. You're a fucking survivor. You are a future witch and I bloody adore you. Thank you so much. This has been a joy.
Look, I invite you all to be part of me and Catelyn's new gang of witches. Let's do it. Get your broomsticks out, babes. Catelyn, thank you for making me laugh. I so needed that. You absolutely have to read her book, More Than a Woman, if you haven't already. Hilarious, brilliant, poignant, beautiful, thoughtful. It's out in paperback right now. Let us know what your favourite quotes of that podcast are over on Instagram. Why not? At Happy Place Official. That's going to be fun. And listen, do make sure you've hit that follow button on the podcast feed because you'll want to be back here next week for a Happy Place First. I'll be chatting to not one, not two, but three wonderful, gorgeous people. Thank you again to Catelyn, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you lot for listening. I bloody love you. I'll see you soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.